You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. It's been almost two decades now since Scott McCloud was here at the Central Library, and I've never forgotten his amazing talk. It was on a series called American Comics with Art Spiegelman, Jules Pfeiffer, and Paul Conrad, and Scott wowed us with his new book at the time, Understanding Comics, which is probably the best analysis of the medium ever written. Art Spiegelman raved that Scott's book, quote, deconstructed the secret language of comics while casually revealing secrets of time, space, art, and the cosmos. And I think he's still doing that in his new books. Over the years, Understanding Comics has become the basic manual for introduction to the medium. Or as one reader said, do not attempt to operate your comic without reading this first, which I thought was very useful. Scott McCloud has also expanded his theoretical books to other titles, including Reinventing Comics and Making Comics. He is the winner of the Eisner and Harvey Awards, and his works have been translated into more than 16 languages. He's also an internationally recognized authority on comics and visual communication, technology, and the power of storytelling. But now he's stepping into the medium in a different way, not as a theorist, but as an artist himself. He's just published a full-length graphic novel, The Sculptor, a virtuosic, funny, and unforgettable new work, which resonated deeply with me, not just because I'm married to a sculptor. It's a graphic epic on artistic inspiration, reputation, and such trifling matters as love and death. And if any of you were at the Orpheum Theater to hear John Waters interview Jeff Koons, just this could be an antidote, really good antidote to that. So Scott's going to talk about his work and discuss it with Elvis. We're delighted to have Elvis Mitchell here, who's a veteran interviewer, host of the pop culture radio show The Treatment on KCRW 89.9 FM, the former film critic of the New York Times and film curator of the year-round programming for Film Independent. Please join me in welcoming Scott McCloud and Elvis Mitchell. Thanks.
Hiya. So, do you need a minute to plug in your axe, or are we?
Yeah, I know it's low battery. I just suddenly realized back there, it's like, oh wow, I have almost no power. Here's my power cord. So, somebody is going to inelegantly sneak in here and do that in a minute.
Well, see, I knew you back when you used to do comic books before they were graphic novels.
Yeah.
And as I was reading The Sculptor, I found myself thinking about this thing that's run through a lot of your work, be it Zot or Destroy, which I happen to love. It's this idea of two people sort of completing each other, these opposites that connect. And I wonder where that comes from for you in terms of your writing.
Yeah, that yin and that yang, yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, maybe it's just I'm sort of looking for some kind of harmony in relationships, but, you know, it's in a lot of ways, whenever I have two characters in any story at all, I always have them drawn towards each other and trying to find some place of agreement and harmony. I'm like, I'm not searching for the kind of conflict that just erodes and explodes and drive, you know, it's like I'm not looking for, you know, Breaking Bad kind of conflict. I'm just like, I see two people, it's like one person's over here and one person's over here, and I think I always look for the ways in which they find each other's common space. And that probably just comes from like the sort of, I don't know, the sort of family life I had or whatever. I'm just like kind of a diplomatic sort of a guy. It's weird. It's like weird. It's just like this notion of civilization as utopia. Like when I was growing up, I was in a high school where all the nerds had their own cafeteria. Like I wasn't shoved in lockers.
Sorry, what?
We like, yeah.
Is this in America? What, well, Switzerland somewhere?
It's Lexington, Massachusetts. It was like this super nerdy town where all these children of engineers and children of professors were. So like we were half the school were basically nerds. And so there was this sense of like this beautiful society where everybody could just just get along and do stuff together. And that's why, maybe that's why also in Zod, in my first comic, I had this. I had that sort of utopian society where which sometimes doesn't make good stories.
Wait, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, like, because if everything is just great, you're done.
But
there's no story, you know?
That would explain CBS. But I think what you do is there is one person for whom a lot of things are great. There is one person so often who is sunny dispositioned, almost Candide-like. And that approach to the world. I mean, you've had Candide
freaked me out when I started hearing it for the first time.
Did it?
Because I realized I had a little pan gloss in me. I was like, seriously, like I was working on Zot, and my wife, who's here, right there, there's Ivy, gave me the soundtrack to Candide, which is a great, if nobody's heard it, this fantastic Leonard Bernstein soundtrack.
Yes.
But I would listen to it, and like, it was scaring me. Because I really, it was positing a universe in which the kind of optimism that I had grown up with was going to lead to disaster. And I took it to heart. It really got to me. It's really interesting.
But that idea of that character, I mean, even in Destroy, these forces who kind of literally kind of complete each other in a way. And there's one who one might call a villain, but who's so exuberant that he destroys everything. But Zach,
so no one was hurt.
Thank God.
No one.
But, well, no. Actual characters, anyway, but Zachary in Zot is Candide.
He really is, yeah. He's a lot like it. And so that notion of hope and disillusionment, this plays out in The Sculptor too, but in a very different way. That's
been consistent. Well, Meg and David, I mean, they're that. And because when I first read it, one of the great things that stuck with me, and I kept going back to this page when David meets his great uncle Harry, and he's showing him an old comic. They drew when he was a kid, and he goes, "You should go off and draw comics. I hear those guys make a ton of money."
Right, and David is like, "I'm not sure that's right."
But there's a model for how many people have had a chance to read The Sculptor yet?
It did just come out a week ago, so also 500 pages.
Yeah, we'll give you a minute while you go through it.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a character in Uncle Harry is based on. You have a real life. Figure that character's based.
I would love to show you just a quick picture of the man that I visually, that's not it, that I visually modeled Uncle Harry on. There we go. That is Lester Ratafia, who is my father-in-law. Lester, unfortunately, passed away about 10 days ago, was it now, Ivy? January 30th, just 4 days before the book came out. And some people have looked at the character of Great Uncle Harry in the book and thought that it looked a bit like Stan Lee, which would be a whole other kind of story. But it was actually Les's wife, widow, I guess, Carol. My mother-in-law is also here tonight. But I just wanted to acknowledge Les. He was a really great guy. Ivy, I think, described him as a feisty old bastard. I think that's about right. But we loved him dearly. His daughter, Holly, is also here. So this is it's a very family book. There are things, if you read the afterword when you get to it, you'll find that there's family kind of wraps up in this thing in a lot of ways.
Including, you want to talk about Ivy's connection to the book as well, apropos.
Yeah, Ivy inspired the character of Meg, who's David's muse, and Ivy's my muse. And yeah, she has that thing, just like with Zot and Jenny from Zot. This notion of, you know, optimism and disillusionment, or like, where does it all lead? And it's very different when Meg offers these reassurances that everything is going to be all right. There's a sort of there's the whole question of delusionment if you really truly believe that we all just end at a certain point. To say that at any point in your life is a kind of willful suspension of the understanding that everybody dies and, you know, it all ends, we're all forgotten. You know, like if you have that as this irrefutable truth, then are you just telling yourself that is that a fairy tale you tell yourself? Or is that something that in an existential sense is kind of true if you want it to be true? You know, so it's a whole different philosophical division between the two of them than it was back in the Zot days.
But I know that, I mean, in that way that Zot often reminded me of, actually, a screwball comedy where you got these two opposites who were sort of destined to be together and set off sparks because they were such opposite personalities. Yeah. There is that aspect to this book too, but I found myself reminded of, knowing, and you reminded me backstage of what a movie lover you are, I found myself thinking of It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, I thought of that a lot. There's even a moment on a bridge that could be seen as like, you know, that point, that lowest point. And I did think about It's a Wonderful Life. Another thing about It's a Wonderful Life is, as you probably know, Frank Capra was really scared that this thing was, as he called it, a piece of cheese, and that he had lost his way. And Jimmy Stewart was like, look, I'll be in anything with you, Frank, or whatever. It's a Wonderful Life is a piece of cheese. I'm going to say it now.
Go ahead, say it.
It's a piece of cheese.
It's a piece of cheese. We're recording this, right?
But okay. I love it. I love it to death, and I love it because God, speaking secularly, small g God, God is in the details. And in the details, that movie says so much about life. And it has such observation. And that's what I tried to do with this story, because this story had the potential to be a big, awful, humorless piece of prog rock. And you know what I mean? You know? It's prog rock, basically.
A little prefab sprout for you there, a little bit of Yes, a little Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. I got you. Okay.
Post Phil Collins Genesis.
But that's really depressing.
But
oh
after
my God.
Trick of the Tail, I mean, I know my prog rock.
So Peter Gabriel, you're saying.
Peter Gabriel's long in the rear view. It could have been that, but I knew it was all going to be up to the details.
But I found myself thinking that, too, just because the Uncle Harry character is like, and I don't want to go too much about sort of religious iconography as sort of figured in, but there's even sort of the idea of the angel comes in. So I saw find myself thinking, in fact, after I first read it, I went and watched It's a Wonderful Life again. You know, just saw so many visual details that seemed to come from there. I mean, just that the idea of the city getting smaller and smaller as David becomes more and more sort of inward and working on the art.
Yeah, now, I didn't see that parallel, but that's a good one. Yeah, you know, one of the one enduring image from It's a Wonderful Life that I always remember, just from a procedural point of view as a storyteller, is the close up. That close up when it finally hits him that this is the entire world is now different because he was never born. And you have that wonderful close up in two shots, I think it is, where he's like looking to the one side and then looking to the other. And I thought how powerful that is because Capra saved it up. And I remember I went to Will Eisner's class early when I was just in New York for the first time.
What was that like?
Oh, it was great. He ran a great class. Spiegelman ran a great class, too. This was at School of Visual Arts.
Yeah.
And I remember showing him Tezuka, the great Japanese master. And
this cover, by the way, reminds me of Tezuka.
Yeah, there's a little Tezuka there. Yeah, no, absolutely.
It's really beautiful.
There's manga all the way through that thing.
Yes, we can talk about that a little bit, but go ahead.
But I love the storytelling techniques in manga, and I was showing it to Will, and I'm saying, Will, have you seen this stuff? This stuff is great. He hadn't seen it, but he liked it right away, and the first thing he did was pick it up, show it to his class, and said, hey, you guys, look at this. This guy is a god in Japan, and he's not a slave to the close-up like you guys are. It drove Will crazy that they were always had to go for the close-up. You save it up. You keep your powder dry and you wait
for
the right moment.
But he went to close-up so often, Will. That's funny that he would say that.
Did he? Oh, yeah. I got to go back and look now.
If you think about those close-up I really happen to love, by the way, is...
Yeah.
Can you...
That's my favorite spread. Sure, I can show that. Yeah, you bet. Do you have the... Oh, page number might be hard.
Page number is 249.
Okay, yeah, I can do that.
Because I mean, there is a real sort of director's eye to your close-up, and I'm so aware of hands and jawlines and how expressive jawlines are in your work, and that's from somebody who really observes people talking. I mean, look at that! Isn't that beautiful?
Thank you.
I mean, that could be. I mean, just you're almost aware of them breathing next to each other.
I hope so. Yeah.
I mean, you get the sensation of it, and Dave even talks about it in the book about skin.
Yeah.
And skin and its textures seem more important in this than anything you've done before. And
absolutely.
I wonder where that comes from in this particular instant.
Well, the physicality of human beings was very important to this book, which was one of the reasons why I found myself in this trap where I had to draw a little bit more realistically than I might have otherwise. Because I'm a great fan, you know, in understanding comics, I talk about the power of cartooning and the very simple imagery. Well, I might have done something that looked like Tezuka. But you know, in 150,000 pages, Tezuka's stuff, the sensuality was always kind of cockeyed and wrong.
Well, two-dimensional, really.
Yeah, it didn't have that true sense of sensuality. And that's really important to this book, not only for the open sensuality of, you know, love scenes and all, but also just the idea of that we are things, because we are things. And all of this are things that, you know, like we are in the physical world. Atoms matter. And so I have to get that across, and that meant working a little bit more realistically. And so here, yeah, you want to have a sense of the actual presence of them as physical beings.
But also the presence of them is compared to the size of the city, where we get a sense of scale and just how intimate this is. I mean, that's really intimate. This is real movie stuff. But apropos that touch I was talking about, on page 224, that two-page spread there is really very much about, as he's working on...
I got it.
We can both get it. As he's... David's a sculptor, and as he's... getting a sense of Meg, this just shows that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd love this. I'd love...
Yeah, and that repeating, like, sort of
this
motif here.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love... Again, you get a sense of what I was saying, the hands and the jawline. And I'm so aware of the way you draw faces and how often, not often, but how you use the angle of the face rather than expression. I mean, the angle of the head, turn to the side or turn down is... You were so good at doing that, using that to evoke emotion. And that's not a Tezuka thing at all.
No, it isn't.
That's more of a film thing, really, than anything else.
I think that might be influenced by film, definitely. Although sometimes, there are things sometimes that feel as if they were appropriating film language that are actually arriving at a sense of verisimilitude from a different direction. You know, if comics really work well, they can use comics' native techniques to give that sense of presence, that sense of nowness, that film also achieves, sometimes more effortlessly. Because, I mean, let's face it, even a kid with a camera can make you feel that, yes, you're looking at a street. A cartoonist has to work at it to make the car look like a car and, the fire hydrant look like a fire hydrant. You know, a movie camera at least gives you a certain leg up on that verisimilitude.
But one of the things that you do so well here, and you talk about understanding comics, is basically using the page to create a sense of time and to direct the reader around. And on page 158, there's a two-page, one I showed to you actually when we were just sitting down doing the test here. That's really...
Oh, yeah.
Incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
And
I mean, yeah. You see, I got to be careful not to say yeah when somebody says something nice about my book. It's like, yeah, that was powerful.
Yeah.
You're correct.
Thank you for agreeing with me about how great your work is. That's really big of
you.
That's
a very good point, Elvis, about its
Thank
power.
You. I think you're great. So, I'm right about you.
Say it as many times as you need to.
Okay. I have notes here. The center of the first page here, that the subway car coming in that tunnel, that's just, I found my eye just looking at the page, so let alone seeing it here. I mean, there's an active sense to those lights as a presence in that page. But there's nothing around that detracts from it. So the idea of keeping that drama going and building from panel to panel to panel to panel to panel. Is just kind of awe-inspiring. I want you to talk
about
the creation.
Actually show it. Yeah.
Okay.
No, I'm agreeing with you. Yeah. Totally works. Yeah, actually, there are like 10 different things going on here.
Okay.
Okay, one of the reasons is, okay, you see that little bit of tone in that panel in particular?
Right.
That's coming from a different place. That is, graphically, we're introducing tone to something that's all line and color. So it's coming from a bit of a different dimension, and so it has a kind of presence that persists. You know, just like the blue fairy in Pinocchio was rotoscoped, and so she always feels like she's coming from another dimension a bit. So this thing, it persists. Also, it's silent. Silent panels tend to permeate the panels around them. They're not resolved. You arrive at them, you move beyond them, but they're still kind of like speaking to you like Hypnotoad in Futurama or something. They just have this kind of persistence.
First time anybody's ever quoted Futurama to me in conversation. This is worth it for that alone.
and then because the sound effects are coming out of the panel, you have this sense that time is bleeding. This happens also with the literal bleeds, what they call bleeds, where a panel goes off the edge of the page. Also helps to convey that sense that the
the time is no longer bracketed off into, no longer siloed into panels. The panels are all leaking. Also, that panel on the upper right-hand corner was directly inspired by Koyana Scotzi.
Oh!
I love, here we go. Yeah, we're going to check the mic. In Koyana Scotzi, there's this...
She's frisking you for a wire to make sure this is okay.
There's this amazing scene where the Philip Glass's music, this is a wonderful film with Philip Glass music if you've never seen it before. Oh, even that's gone. It's just, I'm in a cone of silence.
just talking to my face.
Okay, it'll where be okay. You have these people are just like looking directly in the camera, and behind them like subway trains are like rushing by, and I love that contrast between the stillness of them just looking right at you and the subway train. Oh, I'm back.
Is it? I'm back this way.
I was just falling in love with you, so I'm glad we broke that tension.
So, like, I really like that contrast of the idea of the hands staying still while
you
have the rush.
Yeah, I was telling
you,
talked to you about before, too, the drama in the way you use hands. I mean, wondered, because you don't talk about much in understanding comics, if you studied the way hands will work in photographs or in movies, because hands are really expressive when you work, probably more so than any other artists coming from this medium I can think of. And where does that come from, the idea of hands creating the sense of theater?
Well, I was looking for visual. You're always looking for visual motifs, right? Sure. I've got a sculptor, so that one was a slam dunk, right?
Sure. Okay.
But
it's not just from this, because I remember the difference between Zachary and Jenny and Zot is that there's a kind of constipated quality to Jenny from that sense of anxiety and fear she always has. But Zachary's this.
It's very expansive, yeah.
Yes,
right. In fact, I always go for like expansive versus contractive, like the characters of Cybox and Deco were expansive and contracting. Am I echoing? Is there a weird like bouncing thing?
No, you're just hearing
it's only
things.
For me. Okay.
No.
Yeah. But
tell them, do you guys know who Zybox and Deco are?
These are villains from my first
comic
saw.
Describe
like
Deco.
Two or three
Deco's
people.
My favorite villain in comics history.
Deco has a head that looks like a Chrysler building. He's a cyborg that lost his limbs one at a time and replaced them with machines. But as about halfway through, and you get to imagine what halfway through meant, right? He begins to aestheticize them and sort of like carefully designs them. And he begins to find it beautiful, like that he's designing himself. And he's about humankind becoming machines, but his opposite number is Zybox, which is about machines becoming human. And Zybox has this expansive quality, and Deco has this contracting quality, and Deco has this spiral on his chest, and he's always like, his body language is always like this. So the body language actually, you know, as you were saying with Zot and Jenny, had a specific symbolic resonance for me, and I was trying to work it out. And again, that yin yang thing, right?
Sure.
Yeah. It's just like here are a couple of paired characters that always have to be operating in this mirror image way. Everything about them is mirror image. Like for instance, in the sculptor, I have this. He seems like just kind of like a basic villain in the art world. We've got this guy Finn, but basically Finn is simply the anti-David. My protagonist David has a certain list of qualities, and if you go down that checklist, you'll see that Finn is more or less the opposite in every respect.
But also, too, David wants to sort of work everything out, and yet everything he's worked out, these things he won't do, they're all wrong.
Yeah, no, they're completely. No, he's doomed because, he has this whole rational superstructure that he's worked out for himself that's just basically on a collision course with the world as it is.
Well, you're talking about these sections, too. Again, I interrupted, but I just love that this. For me, the way you use hands has run through your work since I've been reading your stuff.
Oh, right. Oh, the hands thing. Yes, correct. I'm really determined not to just have faces, figures, because a lot of comics are just a whole lot of faces and figures.
Absolutely.
And there are other things in the world to draw, and you can at least start with hands. At least it's a start. You've moved down the body, right? You've come to another part of the body. Hands are good because you have them. They're attached. So if you need to draw them, you can find some nearby. And that's great. But with this one, there are hands everywhere. And there are hidden hands. There are hidden hands in this. Elvis, what state are you from?
Michigan.
So is my protagonist. David Smith comes from Lansing, Michigan, right?
State of Michigan, the state that looks like this.
Exactly. Hidden hand. There are hidden hands all the way through it.
Now I've got to read this thing.
No, he's also from Michigan because when people think of Michigan, they think of a place where they used to make things. And to me, that had a
good night, everybody. I've just been broken inside. No,
but fits him.
But it does. But I mean, again, to this is this idea of you set the vibration up even in that panel, and it's, again, there's just an incredible sense of theater in this, and that kind of theatricality is because yourself, you have a feeling for in your work, I think, melodrama.
Oh yeah,
but you were talking about cheese, and it's not just cheap melodrama. The melodrama comes from these characters who are opposites trying to explain their lives to each other.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's very much a part of the difference between David and Meg here.
Well, some of my favorite comics have been described as melodramas. I like Jar of Fools by Jason Lynch, for example. Yeah. And that is irrefutably a melodrama. But for me, high feelings, high emotions.
Well, you can say high and lowest for a second.
Not so much a melodrama, high and lowest, no. But there's that sense of high stakes and you know, like that you're going, it's operatic, right? It's emotionally operatic. I find that appealing because, you know, I don't know, why not? I've tried, since a lot of my comics began with a kind of adolescent sensibility, I've been moving away from that, but I've been seeing, is it possible, as I'm moving away from that and gaining the perspective of an older writer, an older artist, is it possible that I could maybe not have to completely jettison the intensity, the intoxicating feeling that I had when I was younger? Because I think sometimes we can inoculate ourselves against that and feel as if it's out of limit to write stories in which strong feelings just surround us and drench us and transport us, right? Mm-hmm. That somehow that's not for us. We have to write stories about somebody who, you know, became a masseuse, but then, you know, became interested in...
I don't want to know where this is going.
Yeah, like, you know, it's just like, you know, college professors falling in love with their students. Well, you know, we have to choose smaller things somehow.
Sure.
But I don't know. I just think with this one, this was an idea I had when I was very young, And I'm trying to preserve some of what the good side of melodrama.
But you know, the reason I was talking about melodrama, and there's another panel here that gets to again to pages 12 and 13, which I love because it's the introduction of Uncle Harry, but also you're starting off with these hands at the very beginning.
Yeah.
And just if we look at these pages on page 12 and 13, just the difference between just her hand in this shot with David in that panel. Versus his hands. I mean, we can sort of see there's, she's doing a job, and there's nothing for his hands to do. Just those differences, yeah. I think. And again, for me, one of the thrills of doing this, I got to go back and open up my old Mylar bags and read Zot, and that whiff of carcinogens from those colors in those pages. But there's something that you were talking about, that high spirit. For me, it's the exuberance of pop. There's an unapologetic exuberance of pop
right. That
often runs through your stuff. I mean, people who...
I'm listening to pop a lot of the time as drawing. Well, I'm listening to a lot of kinds of music. Some pop. I like some, you know, some stuff that would be classified as pop, certainly.
Well, what were you listening to when you were... Go ahead, Faust. I don't want you to choke. What were you listening to when you were writing The Sculptor?
I had a lot of playlists. Some of it was just instrumental stuff. So, you know, like there were certain... You know, for instrumentals, I would have like Carnival of the Animals, the Saint-Saëns,
But that's pop.
Pop in its day, yeah. Vaughan Williams was definitely pop.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then I would have like, I would have party mixes for certain kinds of scenes, or I would have dark mixes for others. The Ray LaMontagne song "Be Here Now," I think, really encapsulated a lot of what I was going for.
Oh my gosh! That was
I'm very weepy. I mean, like, I would go for like super weepy stuff. You know, like "Spies" by Coldplay. Yes, I like Coldplay. Don't look at me.
Wow, I've never seen an audience leave so fast in my entire life. That's really, you cleared out the house. Congratulations! But I think the unapologetic exuberance of pop, again, for me, that goes back to Zach, who could be a pop figure.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, it's funny because in that era, there's almost sort of like the contradiction between pop and the British stuff. You know, I mean, Jenny dressed.
Wait, which era? You mean
the beginning of
the
Zot.
80s?
Yeah,
yeah, the 80s era. Yeah,
that 80s era. They were like two different poles of pop. Yeah. And here, it's almost like two different poles of melodrama, or two different poles of sort of drama, where I don't mean comedy and drama, but more like she's in the world. And I mean, that's really the difference. It's a kind of a temporal thing, where she's basically feeling everything as it happens to her, yeah. And he's projecting forward.
In the now, right.
Yeah, that's what right. A sense of being present is kind of something that runs through your work too, isn't it?
Well, and it's also a commentary, in a way, an inadvertent commentary on the sort of the secular versus religious themes. I happen to be an atheist.
They're both Jewish in this.
They are, yeah, but they're also secular. She's Jewish, he's half Jewish,
okay.
Right? But she describes her family as House Special Lomain Jews, which is it's a very New York kind of a thing where
and
it's just
bad House Special.
Yeah,
Jews.
Very bad Jews, right? Which is more or less you guys, my adopted family.
They can hear you.
Yeah. But wait, where was I going with this? Oh, right, I know. The being here now versus versus sort of living for something beyond. David is living for something beyond. He's not religious, right? But what he's doing is a little bit like a religious devotion, this idea of devoting yourself to your afterlife, right? He's obsessed with his afterlife. Yeah. It's just a secular afterlife. This is that last art, in a lot of ways, is that last stage of religious surrender, the idea of that you will live on, you will live on beyond your death, right? That's a kind of faith that we have. And just as with religious faith, what we're doing is we're sort of pushing aside the idea that maybe we'll die, decay, and be forgotten forever, that we cannot last forever. We're trying to push that aside with reassurances that everything will be all right, you know? So to live in the now, in a way, is to, as Meg does, is to embrace the notion that this is all we have, that these are our days, our limited days. Sure. And everybody has a limited number of days.
Yes, I don't want to get too much into this, but it's funny because the idea of religion, you think about how most art was really realized was through religious purposes.
For many centuries, yeah.
And there's also, the way the figurines here are created, the pieces remind me of that kind of religious iconography in art, too.
Yeah, there are several. Yeah, there are definitely images in here that have that traditional Judeo-Christian imagery as well. Sure. I mean, when Meg, it's not much of a spoiler to let you know that when Meg enters the story, she appears as in the form of an angel for reasons.
I was trying to dance around that, but okay.
Yeah, it's okay.
It's your book.
Yeah.
Give it away. I think it's brilliant, by the way.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks.
You can say yes, it is.
Thank you. Yes, it's true.
But
now that you mention it. When to agree and when to say thank you. I'm still working on that.
Walk with me. I'll help you. I think what's so great about your stuff is there's even at the most dramatic, there's still a sense of playfulness. Mm. And I think that's really specific to you. And it's obviously something that's innate. And I wonder when you realize that. I mean, there's that sense of something at play almost always.
Well, it came naturally to the extent that I seem to have always done it in my work. But when I came to the sculptor, where I had these grand, dark, very serious themes,
right.
my editor counseled me that I had to be very, very careful, and that humor was going to be my ally in this one. That I would have to find that playfulness in these unexpected places to inoculate it against being that you know, like overly, you know, portentous, humorless, big gas bag. You know, that it would that without.
But you've never been like that.
I haven't been like that. But this time I was shooting so much. I was really pointing to the rafters. But when I picked up that bat, so I had to have something to counterbalance the seriousness of my themes, and that playfulness was tremendously important in order to pull that off. And this is something that peculiarly I think Joss Whedon understands this. If you go back to Buffy the Vampire Slayer, some of his most serious moments are coupled with these ridiculous little things. Sure. I think it's something that, to be honest, I think Chris Nolan could benefit from. I mean, like, if you go to... I like Chris Nolan. Wait, hang on. I love Chris Nolan's movies. I really loved
The Prestige is one of my favorite
movies.
Well,
that's got a real sense of play in it.
Yeah, it does have
that,
it.
Actually, this is the one that has that playfulness.
But can you imagine, like, wouldn't it have been cool, though, if Inception had, like, just some more humor? Like if, what if there was somebody on the team who was, like, the mom scrubber who, like, every time the dreamer's mom would show up in the dream, like wearing, like, tights and holding cookies or something like that, that he would be the guy who eliminates the mom from the dream? Why were all the dreams about big, heavy metal things hitting other big, heavy metal things? Is that really plausible? Is that what dreams are really like? I'm sorry. It's just a thing. But I'm just saying that. So I was worried about.
Just lay down on the couch and tell me more about these things that are bothering you.
I was worried that the whole thing would feel like I was pushing too hard for us to always be it's so important, you know. I didn't want it to be self-important, and that so that humor, that playfulness, and that unpredictability,
yeah,
like was really important, not to counteract the seriousness of the purpose, but to bolster it. It actually, because it provides the same kind of dynamic contrast that two-page spread we're looking at with the hyper close-up of the two of them,
sure,
and then the long shot of the street. The close-up gains power from the long shot. The long shot gains power from the close-up, just like Capra and his close-up in It's a Wonderful Life, gaining its power from all the times he held back and showed us restraint. You know, it's dynamic range. And I think sometimes people they shoot for a tone and they try to maintain that tone from beginning to end, whether it's a graphic novel or a movie or a TV show or a piece of music, they try to sustain a tone. But that tone is more powerful when it's seen as the product of dynamic contrast. So that's what I was going for. Yeah.
But I think, too, if we look at this, if we just follow these two pages, I mean, there's that sort of sense of directing the eye, of creating that sense of drama, of localizing it so it's to the hands. And then here in the last panel, Uncle Harry gets an actual entrance. This is like something out of a movie. This is why I love this panel so much.
Well, it's because it's POV. You know, there's that sense, okay, where did we set down the camera?
Sure.
It's also manga, though. Manga has always done that. The thing that makes manga different from the European style or the American style is that in manga, you're always situated inside the action or inside the head of one of the actors. And that's why we don't do that here.
But that's also something from Japanese cinema too. That's Ozu. I mean,
yeah.
And
Ozu may have influenced a lot of the manga.
Oh, no two ways about it.
I am way behind on my Ozu. I will admit it right now. I got a lot of Ozu to catch up on.
Well, I won't go any further into that. But I will say that one of the Ozu thing is the camera being slightly lower, and which is here, that when Uncle Harry shows up.
Yeah.
I mean, he leans into the frame.
Right, which gives you a sense of how physically, literally low David is, but also that, like a child, he's laid low. Yeah, absolutely. It's going back to Kubrick and the big wheel.
Sure, yeah. But also something to look up to. There's a friendly face here that he's looking up at. I mean, it makes him
seem parental, yeah.
Yes, but also seems to imply deliverance. I mean, a helpful hand, somebody coming in to save him. There's, I mean, in emotional terms, there's so much going on here, starting with the overhead shot in the top at the diner, just down to here.
Yeah.
I mean,
and we should say, for contrast's sake, these are the panels right before. And if you look, it's a little hard to see, but there are these. Actually, if you check the new issue of Entertainment Weekly, there's a two-page spread about my use
Coldplay
of lettering.
Coldplay and Entertainment Weekly? Why don't you shoot me in the face?
And so... So you can see this is the panel right before, right? You see this little word balloon. It's like he doesn't even know. Somebody's talking to him. He doesn't even know who it is. And we've got this hyper close-up of the hands. And then you have that long shot. See, that's the next panel.
But go back to that page again, because, again, we can see the purpose in the hands here and then the lack of purpose there. I mean, basically, that's almost like Michelangelo's David. I mean, that's the Pietà, these hands.
Yeah, right. Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, people like Michelangelo understood that the hands were at least as expressive as the face.
Oh, and there's so much so much comes out of that sort of sense of looking for supplication. I mean, that's what those hands are doing here. Help me. I mean,
oh, yeah, absolutely. And, like, look at the semiotics of just, I write about this in Making Comics, like, just the difference between this and this.
Sure.
Right? If you want to seem honest and open, you do this. You put your hands up, because this is like you're placing yourself lower, like you're the beggar. saying, you know, please, please, may I have a dollar or whatever like that. So you're saying, I am, you can trust me because I am lower than you. I am less powerful than you. Whereas when you do this, you're asserting your authority. You say, now everybody settle down. It's like, politicians will do this.
Absolutely.
When they want to get across this, oh yeah, now,
or America, evangelists.
Or televangelists. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I guess I want to ask you, it's a really loaded thing in choosing the name David Smith, given the yeah. kind of name, given the kind of sculptor that David Smith was. And I wonder where that came from. Was that your starting point at this? Or?
Actually, you know, I had a teacher, a painting teacher at Syracuse University when I was a fine arts major against my will. I really wanted to be an illustration major, but they wouldn't let me in.
Those comics guys make a ton of money according to this book.
Yeah, so I hear. So for one semester, I was a painting major, and I had a teacher named David Smith. He was he was David Smith the painter, which is, you know, in some ways it's like, oh, okay, you know, that's not quite so bad. Right, because, well, he's the painter. That's the difference. He gets that territory, right? whereas to be the other David Smith, also the sculptor, but not the sculptor, that's just far worse. And, you know, so he's stuck with that. But the other thing is there's the dichotomy between my protagonist and the famous David Smith.
Sure.
He's the other David Smith. But then there are the other David Smiths. There are
that
phone book filled with David Smiths.
Yeah. Yeah. And that name becomes a point too. But again, that is almost a screwball comedy thing.
Yeah,
starting
is,
off
yeah.
with that. I mean, I also find myself thinking too a little bit here in these first few pages of The Lost Weekend,
which I haven't seen.
Okay, but that, you know, that sense of sort of black and white, this noirish. Mm. I mean, if you think about that, or a little bit of Sunset Boulevard.
Oh yeah.
I mean, that I got that sense from this too. I mean, a guy looking. Again, those hands.
Well, I think there's inevitably there's definitely a sense of noir, partially because the notion of the lone protagonist lost in a world of hard edges. You know, that's a very noir thing,
sure.
And that's definitely the world that David is lost in. And it's easy to do it in New York. You know, it'd be a little bit harder if he was, you know, living in Pasadena or something.
But there's
I don't know. Maybe
been
not.
In Pasadena?
not recently, actually. That's a nice town, I hear.
So I hear. But, but one of the things that this I like about this, too.
How do we get off on that?
I have no idea. I'm so drunk right now. one of the things I really like about this is there's a sense of timelessness to it, which it's almost happening out of time in a way.
I hope so, yeah.
I'm not really sure what era it's taking place. I mean, it's clearly contemporary. But at a certain point, there's so much about intimacy and the need for contact.
Yeah.
That the idea of a time period disappears after a bit, and I wondered.
I hope so. Yeah.
How you arrived at that sort of storytelling, a prerogative?
Well, I definitely didn't want it to feel like it was too much of its time.
Okay.
Partially because I have very little to say about this era versus any other era in particular.
Really, because it feels to me about a little bit about the way that we've been sort of detached from other people just because of. Social media, I mean, it's not directly in this, but there's a sense of David being out of touch with everything.
Right. And, well, he's not connected. I mean, like, both physically and electronically, right? He doesn't, he breaks his phone, doesn't have his phone anymore, which is something that you always have to do. It's funny. Like, storytellers will tell you this, okay, when does he lose his phone? Because otherwise there's no story. Because as soon as you have a problem, it's just call somebody. What's wrong with you?
Yeah, if you're drawing him texting all the time,
yeah, right.
I'm sure you lost a lot of pages
of
that.
You'll see people texting.
His phone is even turned off. I mean, you really take him out of the world. You detach
right.
him from everything.
He is detached. And there are a lot of, if you look closely, there are a lot of motifs of detachment and separation. There are a lot of crowd rings in this story and several
including
different
statues
places.
Of a crowd
yeah,
ring.
Yeah,
right. And also his fantasy of at one point he touches Meg's hand and he sees there's this ring of infinite ring of people.
Right. There's all these generations going back. Her mother, and then they form a ring. There are hidden crowd rings. But that whole notion of like okay, the separation, like he's separated, like a drop of soap going into dirty water. You know how the dirt just goes like that. That's him and the rest of the human race. There's a separation between him and the rest of the human race.
We can go to page 28 before I'm
sure.
going to go to questions. You guys start thinking about your questions. 28 and 29, I mean, there's something so astonishing about those two pages that I kept every chapter I come back to those to reorient myself. And these two pages alone could be a story. I mean, more so than any two other pages in the entire piece. Starting with, again, the overhead shot. And again, you take us back that, so we see what's going on here. But also we look at sort of how vividly he's depicted versus everything else in the shot. You can't quite see it from the, but you guys, when you guys pick this up in the lobby, because they'll be signing these after. Did I plug it? No Entertainment Weekly, but I do what I can do. the world around him is disembodied, and then there's a cut to that storefront, which is a little Seinfeldian, but also
just a bit, yeah.
But also a little bit about again, just being lost in a big city. You go from that sort of sense there to be like being there, and then the next panel is the girl sitting at the booth behind him, who's the sweetest thing. I love this kid. I mean, she makes such a great entrance. She's sitting behind him as he's wallowing in self-pity, saying, it's my birthday. It's my birthday, too. I love New York. I'm from St. Louis. I hear it's a great city. Yeah, we're going to go to 3 shows and a museum and a statue. I mean, this.
That was almost a perfect recitation of that conversation, by the way. That was great. No, I'm serious. That was beautiful.
You wrote this stuff. I'm just remembering it.
I'm really impressed.
Yes, you did a good job. Congratulations. There's so much going on in these two pages. Again, these two pages could have been a story. Mm-hmm. Again, just these two pages are their own story. We start with his loneliness. We go to her, this beautiful girl whose parents are, he's crazy. No, he's just lonely. She gets him.
Like she really does.
Yes. And that's the thing too. There's that sort of sense of that sense of innocence,
and that sense of potential redemption. It's like he's not without potential connections, right? There are human beings out there who may understand him. It's partially voluntary that he separated himself from humanity.
But even
it's not hopeless for him.
Absolutely. But even getting to make somebody can see him, if he allows himself to be seen.
Exactly.
I mean, that this sets it up again. This is foreshadowing here. Yeah. But just going through all this too. His uncle sort of forecasting this future, that would be okay.
It'd be okay, yeah.
It'd be just fine. Yeah. You know, I mean, to walk us through this a little bit before we go.
Yeah, we should say, basically, this is just after David has discovered the nature of the grand uncle Harry that's come to visit him. And there's a supernatural element here. And Harry tells him exactly how his life could be, how he had a nice starter house, meet a nice girl at Best Buy, get married, have a couple of kids, and he could just live
a perfect... yellow lab.
Yeah, little yellow lab. And basically, he could have a normal life. And a key thing here is where Harry, when David says, that's not me, and Harry says, why? Why couldn't that be you? It's a good life.
What's wrong with love and a family?
Exactly, yeah. And these are no small things. And look, billions of people on this planet would kill for that life. You know, like we don't realize that here in developed nations. That it's like, that's a really big deal to have a roof over your head, to be able to buy food and that sort of thing. But David needs something more. And we know that something more is the art, that urge to create that drives the story in a lot of ways. Yeah.
Okay, if you guys are ready, it's about time for your questions. So if you raise your hand, we'll have somebody come to you with a microphone. Oh, here's a very serious thing from a black leather jacket. That's got to be a serious question right here.
First question.
Yeah, this is for Elvis. At the risk of sounding like an Arschlecker, I want to say how much I appreciate the treatment. My question for you is,
who is
your Greta Garbo? Who is the person that you've wanted on the show and just never, ever, ever got?
Ooh.
There we go. This is easy. This is easy. I love this guy's work. When I first met him at Golden Apple in 1990, I ran up to him breathlessly and go, I'm sorry, I think this is the greatest comic book of all time. And all these things I'm talking about here, that sense of pop exuberance, that sense of sort of pitting things against each other, but also the fact that unlike there's a sense of emotional dimensionality to these comics where you go back and you read and you see what's really going on. I mean, and like a movie, like a piece of literature, like a piece of art, there are layers that unfold. I cannot recommend you guys enough to A, get this, which I think is in the lobby, you can get it signed. And, but also there's a great collection of Zot, HarperCollins put out.
That's right, yeah.
It's a tome, but you go through it like nothing and then you go back and read it again and again. So,
wow, thank you.
Thank you. So another question here, we have one. Yes, sir.
Hi, Scott. Big fan of Understanding Comics.
Thank you.
And one of the things that hit me really hard was the difference between comics and movies, comics and movies, and how there's the gap, the time gap in between each picture.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could give us specific examples in this book of like where you're using that tool to tell the story.
Well, in a way, you know, we use it, of course, all the time because the cut, in a lot of ways, the gap between panels and comics is most analogous to the cut. Because
it's something even Eisner talked about.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And Eisner was blown away when he saw Citizen Kane, and that kind of set him on his course. Which is interesting because in his later work, it's more theatrical in a lot of ways. It feels more like it's on stage. But
Very much Contract with God. Those are all basically they could be Arthur Miller plays.
Yeah, his final act, basically the graphic novels. They do feel more like plays. But I think that. It's okay. There's the stuff that's sort of like the heart of the art of comics is that gap between the panels. But then of course you also have a similar kind of closure happening just with the persistence of memory in the way that in film, that's just kind of the texture of film. And it's very difficult not to see that motion, not to see that life happen when the images are just like going one right after another. But I think, I don't know. In the book. Oh, God.
Oh, hi, Ivy.
Oh, let's see. Oh, actually, you know what? The page you were just having us look at actually is a good example of that. And it relates back to here. We were just there.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a good example, okay? What's happening here is you have all of these different fragments that Elvis had pointed out, like we have the exterior shot, we have the overhead shot, we have these different realities, these different frequencies, right, of like this perfectly happy party happening in the booth next door. Right up at the bar, somebody is like watching a sports game. All of these things are happening simultaneously. And what I'm trying to do is to give you the opportunity to stitch them together. And in film, that's definitely possible, but in comics you have this simultaneity. Because, you know, in film, yes, there's the now, there's memory, and there's anticipation. In comics, memory and anticipation and now are all at once. They're all in a single map. And so you're continually sort of reasserted with that simultaneity. And you also have the symbolism and power that static images have that have a direct conduit to memory.
Absolutely.
You know, that and people who study memory or do things like competitive memory exercises, those guys all trade in static imagery. It's a really powerful memory tool. You know, look at airline safety cards, you know, same thing.
Yeah, another question, yeah. In the same row, perfect.
Hi. This is a question for both Scott and Elvis. I'm more curious about the preparation for Scott, your writing and drawing process of how you approach it. And Elvis, how do you get ready for your guests? Do you do like any background studies before you prepare for a show?
As you can see, I don't know anything about his work at all. So I'm just going by the seat of my pants. Go ahead, Scott.
Sure, I can actually show you here. I'll show you just a little bit of process, as a matter of fact. You know, here, my ideas go way back, for this particular book, go all the way back to high school in this goofy three-ring binder that I had in high school. And here's some notes that I was taking on the sculptor when I had this whole year when I could just think about it. But when I got down to the actual process of laying it out, this is what it looked like. That's 40 pages in Photoshop on a single document. And these are pretty detailed, actually. If you go, any one panel had a lot of detail in it. All right, so that's 40 pages at once. And the reason I did this was because then, just like with a word processor, I could just decide if I wanted, I could take a panel out, and I could put it on this sort of, you know, like this tray, this blank space up there. I could, you know, put it aside until I needed it later, and it would join other panels. And then again, just like when you're writing a paper in a word processor, I could reintroduce panels and have other things just kind of reflow. And the important thing for me was that this allowed me to have a general kind of forward flow to the narrative and not get too hung up on any individual page. That was a really big deal. But then when I was ready, when the page was acceptable, then I could take that page, bring it into Illustrator to create the lettering, and then bring the resultant thing into Photoshop.
But in Illustrator, what I did was I created basically windows. These panel borders, they're not just lines, they're windows. This stuff is opaque. So when a line goes over the panel border, it goes behind the panel border. So I have these windows in front of the balloons, in front of the art, and I would just draw the art behind it. And I would take those layouts, and the and here I had these different actions in Photoshop that allowed me to do a lot of things in automated stuff on this Cintiq, where I could change from one brush to another with these side buttons. And I just sat and drew all day. But I took those layouts and brought them in, and then I would just work them up in layer after layer after layer. You know, I could put in perspective lines like that until I had something that looked, you know, like the way I was, the way I wanted it to look, like a subway station in this case. You know?
How long did it take you to do the whole thing?
The whole book took me 5 years. 2 years of layouts, 3 years of finished art. The layouts, before I ever did a single piece of finished art, I had to draw the whole thing in that rough version, all nearly 500 pages, from beginning to end. That took me a year. And then I revised it. I did four drafts.
How different is the first draft from the last draft? Because we could see panels and the roughs that didn't exist in this version.
Yeah, it changed a lot. I really went back. I went back and ripped it up. I always try to get friends, honest friends, to tell me everything that's wrong with my stories, and they helped me out. But I also had a really good editor this time, Mark Siegel at First Second Books, and he helped guide me to like really ripping up the floorboards. And in the fourth draft, I found I got to that sort of new state of matter or whatever, where I was no longer fixing things, but I was just uncovering all the crap between me and my story. Mm-hmm. It was more like excavating the story.
Sure.
And that was really cool. So you have to draw it before. The thing is, okay, before I write my story, I need to read the story. Because I need to read the story to understand what the story is about. But before I can read the story, I need to write the story. So I write it, then I can read it, and then I can write it, then I can read it, then I can write it, then I can read it. I really do believe that Ernest Hemingway was right. The first draft of everything is shit. And that was something that I got to, you know, put into practice on this one.
How much do you love the idea what technology has done, the way it's given you this idea to do it, so you're not actually hand drawing, you have this, you can move panels around this way?
Well, I am literally hand drawing, because, you know, I'm doing it on the Cintiq. Right. The difference is that now I can modify those drawings.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there are artists that are just naturals. There are people like Craig Thompson or Jillian Tamaki who are just, they just start drawing and it just flows out of their hands, or Mobius. You know, these are amazing artists who never have to even think. I'm not one of those people, right? For me, it doesn't come as naturally. So what I do is I draw
Which comes more naturally to you, the writing or the art?
Better at the writing, and I'm good at things like perspective. This is a pretty good piece of perspective. Yeah. But the figure drawing, the faces, the construction, that's hard.
Yeah.
And so working digitally, I can revise. I can draw the thing once, say, wow, that kind of sucks, right? I don't have a good hand, but I have a good eye. So I know this thing needs work, and I can work at it. Because I've worked at it in 40 different layers, I can grab things, I can resize them, I can move them, I can fix them.
Yeah.
And that worked really well.
Another question? Yeah.
You mentioned that you had the initial idea for this, for Scott, about 20 years ago. Yeah. Was it always going to be in this form? Did the story have to be told this way until you had 5 years to work on it and a place in your career where someone would say, yes, Scott, we'll publish a 500-page single shot thing? I mean, could it have existed in sequential form, I mean, in monthlies, or was it always going to be this form?
Because it isn't the chapters look like they could be monthly installments.
Yeah, almost, yeah. But I think it really, I wanted to have that all-at-once-ness. I like that idea of it landing with a boom. I like that idea of it being that satisfying chunk. This is something that the writer Heidi McDonald talked about. Comics are just, they go by too quick. I don't like those 22-page packages. There's just not enough story content. Also, we're at a disadvantage because our price per minute's kind of high compared to, you know, video games. it's just a thing. It's a practical thing. You know, I'm thinking about comics generally. But no, it always, to me, felt like it needed to be a graphic novel because it needed to reach whatever length it needed to get to, right? The thing started out like 420 pages, ended up like nearly 500 pages. But that's because it had to grow, just like a movie. You don't decide ahead of time that the movie is going to be exactly 118 minutes. You know, you're struggling against, you know, producers and budgets and things if you try to push that length. But you hope, ideally, it's going to reach whatever length feels about right, you know? Whatever length suits the needs of the story. And that was something I was allowed to do here. But it had to be now because 10 years ago, I probably couldn't have gotten a situation where, frankly, I could be paid to sit on my ass for 5 years while I worked on this thing 11 hours a day, 7 days a week. It was a massive undertaking. I don't know. It's just I don't know. It was time. It just felt like it was the right time. It's weird. It's just like I reached that point where it could be made to happen. That I could, you know, set aside that safe thing. And also the publisher, that really the only right publisher for this book had to come into existence.
Okay, because I wanted two more questions.
Sure. I think we're losing your mic a bit now, but basically you were wondering if now was the time when, like, emotionally, like, I wasn't necessarily ready before, and the answer is absolutely yes. I came up with the idea when I was a young man, when I was only in my 20s, when I was half the age that I was when I started drawing. And it's a young man's idea. It's a power fantasy. It's all about art and life and death and all these big, giant things. That's a young man's story, right? But the older man came to this story and thought, okay, now maybe I have the perspective to give this thing the right way, the right treatment. Maybe I have come to the point where I have lived long enough that I can write this story competently. But what I wanted to do was bring that perspective of the older man to it while still preserving the vitality of the younger man's idea. And now is definitely, I could not have written this 10 years ago. I don't know that I could have written it 7 years ago. It had to be now. I just somehow come, well, also, you know, it was funny, while I was working on it, I had this health emergency. I was at Neil Gaiman's 50th birthday party in New Orleans, and and I was there for 10 minutes, and I had kind of a heart attack. What would we call it? I don't know what it was exactly, but I found myself in the hospital. And yeah, a dissected artery.
Same thing that killed
John Ritter. Yeah, but you know, so I actually got to have a little encounter with death too, and I don't know, maybe I needed that too.
Hello, I read your The Morning Improv back then, and I like the one about the person speaking to himself, but here's my question. What do you think of the storytelling of the European format, and will it work in the book that you made? Sorry, I have a slow mind.
That's right. So the European format, you mean the physical format of of European comics?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm a great fan of the Franco-Belgian tradition. And, you know, earlier I was talking about how in Japanese comics there's that sense that you are here, that sense of being in the middle of the action and in the middle of the head of the protagonist. In the European tradition, thanks largely to Hergé and Tintin, we have a tradition of world building. And that's something that runs from generation to generation to generation, all the way up like through 50 years of European comics. World building is really important.
It's also the sense of the French and the British building empires anyway.
Oh, yeah, I know how they were building worlds, weren't they? Yeah. And what's cool is, like, starting in the late 80s, early 90s or so, you start to have Miyazaki and Otomo, these Japanese filmmakers and manga artists who began to embrace that sense of world building, and now all of a sudden you add that cross-pollination. But up to that point, these were really three separate worlds. The North American world, the European world and the Japanese world. And that was something that I really loved about it. And the format helped give you that sense, that graphic album, right, that we had for many years in Europe before they were here, before they were popular here.
Next, last question right over here.
Thank you. I'm kind of nervous.
Deep breath. It's cool.
You can do it.
All right. Thanks, guys. I have a question about the panel that you showed on 11 and 13 with his hands on the table. There's excellent exposition here going on, moment to moment, and his hands are actually on the plate and the fork. There they are. Well, he's feeling, it seems that he's feeling those objects. I was wondering, actually on page 11 as well, but he's deep in thought.
Yeah.
I was wondering, is he feeling, there's a lot of exposition with his hands. He's showing as you were saying, the palm and then above his hand, and also feeling the items on the table, as I said earlier. I was wondering, what is he thinking? Is he thinking about, is he looking at his hands? Is he thinking about shaping those objects? I was wondering, what were you thinking what is he thinking when he's doing that too on the table with his hands?
Yeah.
In the original version of this, actually, before I started trimming words, he was actually talking a little bit to them. He was talking to the table, and he said something about, like, what kind of tree were you before they cut you down, you know? And what he's doing is, there are two things happening here. One is trying to understand the physical world, but the other thing is desperately reaching out and trying to connect to something. So it has a sensual quality to it of like somebody who is desperate for any kind of connection. Touch is really important to this guy. You know, like just having this woman that he's in love with brush past him in the kitchen is a very big deal to him. So there's that sense of, this is the only thing he can touch. This is the only thing he can connect with. He's desperate to connect with the world and to have some kind of relationship with things, because things are all he has when this story starts. And so I think that's what I was sort of thinking. But in the end, because I had a good editor, he helped me to open it up so that rather than my telling you what he's thinking, I might instill in you the curiosity about what he was thinking.
It's that thing you were talking about, the idea of saving your shot so you're not using it up, but also gives a reader a point of entry and also a point of empathy. I can't say enough good things about this book or about this guy. I love his work. I'm so glad I was asked to do this. He's signing copies out in the lobby. Ladies and gentlemen, it's your friend Scott McCloud.
Thank you. Thank you, Elvis.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.